concerned are you by leadership change at the Federal Reserve?
Well, not overly concerned. I don't expect the Fed to, you know, move aggressively. They have a nice path of being able to exit by just, you know, by the fact that a lot of the bonds they hold is going to expire and they're going to be able to contract the balance sheet smoothly.
The biggest ever battle to shake up a corporate boardroom is so close that Procter & Gamble is declaring victory, but its adversary is not conceding defeat. Preliminary results Tuesday suggest shareholders sided with the company in a battle royale pitting P&G against Nelson Peltz, an activist investor with a $3.5 billion stake in the company through his hedge fund, Trion. Peltz agitated for a seat on the board so he could push through his growth plan, which centered around a reorganization into three distinct units.
How do we prepare for 2018? How do we prepare around the world? There will be a new prime minister elected or one reelected in Canada in 2019. There will be a presidential race here in the United States in 2020. Let's assume that people are unfortunately going to get more sophisticated in trying to abuse these social media platforms. They're going to get more sophisticated in these cyber attacks on political candidates. How do we get better as a tech sector? How do we work more closely with the government? How do we ask the governments of the world, of the democratic countries of the world, to use their voice together to say, this is an attack on democracy and it needs to stop?
WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the program. Today is Wednesday. It's October 11th, 2017. Glad you're here. Welcome to another business day. It's 5:11, and we've got a good show for you this morning. In a minute, we're going to bring in Doug Roth from Playground Hospitality in Chicago to talk about the business of restaurants. That'll be a great conversation, as always. You can bet on it. And then a little bit later in the program, we're going to be talking about the business of law with law and manufacturing reporter Claire Bushy. Billable hours, are they going bye-bye? We'll talk about that a little bit later in the program. But first, on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, we're looking for a flat open on Wall Street later this morning with futures now in the negative, but only by single digits on the Dow, S&P, and NASDAQ. In Europe this morning, markets are generally mixed with numbers up in down in London, up in Germany, and down in France. And in Asia this morning, markets are generally mixed as well, with the Nikkei up about 0.25% and the Hang Seng off about 1/3. The Shanghai up just a fraction this morning. Oil is trading at $51.35 a barrel, which is up almost 1%. Some news that's happening this morning in the world of business. Britain's finance minister says a worst-case Brexit scenario could see all air traffic between the UK and the European Union grounded the day after Britain leaves the bloc in March of 2019. Philip Hammond was answering lawmakers' questions today about government planning for the possible divorce and how it could end on a sour note on trade, security, and other relations. He says it's conceivable there will be no air traffic between the UK and the European Union on the 30th of March 2019. He says obviously everybody is working and planning for all scenarios to avoid that. Speaking of airlines, airline stocks surged after American and United slightly sweetened their outlook for third quarter revenue. The two carriers are the biggest gainers among the Standard & Poor's 500 yesterday. Investors have grown concerned about slower growth in revenue from tickets and fees, partly due to a fair war between Chicago-based United and discounters like Spirit Airlines. Heavy discounting has threatened to halt a rally in revenue that's helped airlines post strong gains in recent years. And Sears Canada says it is seeking court approval to liquidate its roughly 130 remaining stores in Canada and leaving about 12,000 employees without a job. The embattled retailer has been operating under the company's Creditors Arrangement Act since June. It said that it had failed to buy a buyer and that it would allow it to continue. And so it is winding down. Again, these 130 remaining Sears stores in Canada. The business of restaurants. A lot going on these days. We've had a couple of big restaurant closures, and we're headed into a period that could be a slow time for some restaurants. Doug Roth is here. He is the founder and president of Hospitality, Playground Hospitality. You may remember, Doug, from restaurants like Bistro 110, Bistro 100, of course, Black Hawk Lodge. And Doug is with us this morning here in the studio. Doug, good morning. Welcome to the Opening Bell.
Thanks. Always glad to be here.
We're going to talk a little bit about some restaurant trends, but since the last time you were here, True closed. I was surprised that that happened, but I'm guessing you're not.
Well, I have to say that that restaurant has had a wonderful run. It began many, many years ago under Rich Melman and also his partners. And over a period of time, it has contributed a lot to the culinary scene of Chicago. But with everything, there's change. And part of that change is how people dine. And I think really what's happened is with True and other restaurants in the city, too, that we've seen, that the area of fine dining at this point is being challenged. And I think that that was one concept at this point that had a fabulous run. But, you know, I think with anything else, Steve, that you have to know when to say when. And I think Let Us Entertain You knows that, and they're really good at taking those concepts and reconcepting them as well.
All good things come to an end, I think, is probably a good way to say that.
Oh, yes.
But it brings to mind, you mentioned the changes, disruption in the restaurant industry, some of it being caused by technology. What else are you seeing in that area?
Well, I think what we're seeing is that there is a very clear shortage in labor. And one of the things that restaurants are trying to do today is to figure out the labor model and what is going to be ideal for them as far as being able to produce their product, but do it efficiently. Because what's happened is that it's gotten very tight here in Chicago. It's gotten very, very tight in places like Orlando, the East Coast as well. And you need to find ways from a technological standpoint of how to produce food with not as much labor. We were talking earlier about the robot that you saw that was tossing a salad.
Yeah.
Maybe not so far away from that.
Yeah, and it's funny because there's not only a robot that tosses the salad, but they're testing some of them out in the fast food places specifically. But, you know, they do everything from wash the dishes to make hamburgers to doing all kinds of things. Are those the kinds of jobs that you'd foresee the robots taking over, the ones that are doing those sort of meaningless?
Well, I think what you're saying is that those that maybe are not necessarily seen by the guest.
That's right. Yeah.
I think that maybe that's another way
behind
of putting it.
Yeah.
Behind the scenes, exactly. You could see the automation happening in that sort of fashion. I never think you want to ever feel that you're not going to be able to touch the guest and be able to interact with the guest, no matter what your concept is. So I think what we'll seeing is more automation and preparation, as you were saying. But I think we're also going to be seeing a lot more kiosks and a lot more ways to access food. There's a fridge that's out there that has different jars of food that are in very high volume places like airports and convention centers, where it's nicely pre-prepared food that are in jars, and it's called Farmer's Fridge is the name of it. And so those type of kiosks, Shake Shack just announced that they're doing a cashless kiosk as well. So all these sort of ways of, one, building additional sales, but also reducing labor is what's coming.
Part of this, too, is the app. We've seen lots of different places come up with apps. Starbucks does one now where you order ahead of time. McDonald's is doing one. That's fast food. But is this coming to fine dining, do you think, as well?
I see it proliferating everywhere. And what's occurring is that if it's in Starbucks or if it's more in your fast casual, or as Danny Meyer said a couple nights ago on 60 Minutes, fine casual, and all the way up to fine dining, that what we're going to be seeing is the day of our millennials, which is here, who have a phone in their hand all the time, that they are going to find a way in order to order food. And it doesn't matter if it's Starbucks or if it's Spiaggia. They will be using that phone as a method. And I think what we're going to be also seeing is that we're going to have those individuals take precedent when they enter into an establishment. I can't tell you how many times that I've been in Starbucks and been waiting in line, and then some person comes in and gets their carryout order ahead of my order. What the philosophy is that Starbucks says, well, hey, we already have that person in line. That person's there. But it's important that the experience of the carryout individual be, one, timely, which they're really looking for, that it's consistent, that it's going to taste the same way every time, whatever that drink is or whatever that pasta is, and that in addition to that, that that person is going to be able to take it back and have it prepared in the same fashion that they're used to having it prepared at the restaurant as well. So there has to be that level of continuity. Not every restaurant has learned yet that you need to have certain items on your carryout menu and certain items you want to keep at the restaurant.
A couple of things there, but back to the app. If you had to design one for a restaurant, what would you say the key points would be? Would it be that you can reserve a seat? Can you reserve a seat and order your meal? Peruse the menu? What would you include on your dream app?
Well, I don't know if I really want to tell you that.
Okay.
I'm just kidding. My dream app is well, fortunately, I've married my dream woman, so right. This would be my dream app. I think what we'd want to do is not necessarily reservations. I think the Open Tables of the world and others that are out there today have done a really good job with that. Now, those have gotten to be very expensive for restaurants as well, and we probably could do a whole other segment mm-hmm. on online reservation systems. I think probably what you want to be able to do is no different when you are perusing a website. Quickly be able to, within a couple different opportunities, to be able to just say, this is what I want to eat, this is how much this is going to cost, and this is going to be what I'm going to have at checkout. Mm-hmm. And make it really sort of simple, straightforward, and feature those items that have, most importantly, low food cost and high gross profit margin. Engineer the app so that it works for you from a profitability standpoint.
The delivery part of this, back to the delivery part of this, I am not surprised to hear you say that you got to have two separate menus, because I think we've all ordered something from a restaurant and it's arrived in not so good condition. I could see how that would be positive. But do restaurants want to encourage what Starbucks is doing, and that is ordering food and having either people come and pick it up walking in front of people, or having their own delivery service? Do they have a third-party delivery service? What are the trends there?
Well, the trends right now are more to have a third-party delivery service, the Grubhubs of the world. It's very expensive to have your own delivery service. Actually, one of the first delivery services in Chicago was developed by a guy named Brian Kyle. Brian Kyle may sound familiar to you because he basically took Potbellies and exploded with it ultimately, and then obviously did an IPO and then went public with it. During one of his earlier positions in the world, where he had something called room service. And it was a very expensive proposition for the restaurant, because you have to take a certain percentage off of what you're selling your food at, in addition to what the service charges are. But it does work out better than you having to pay for insurance on the vehicle that's delivering. And there's a whole lot of infrastructure that you'd like to outsource. And that's probably the word of today, and if not the world, word of the future, is outsourcing.
Let's talk a little bit about restaurant slowdowns. You mentioned this earlier about how all restaurants go through this period of slowdowns. What are the key ideas here for helping fill that with something that's going to make money for the restaurant?
Well, I think we all go through cycles, and every January, I always wanted to feel that this would not be the January that we would see the massive slowdown. But inevitably, you know, the first or second week in January, you start seeing a bowling alley in your restaurant. Those that don't, they're very lucky. But most restaurants obviously have the cycle. Shame on the restaurateur or anyone in business who doesn't take a look at these things a year in advance, or if not 6 months in advance, realizing that you're going to have that issue. So you need to sort of obviously be very proactive. And part of that proactiveness is, okay, let's introduce something new in January. Let's go to tablets. Let's have something that we can announce to our public and our guests that we're doing differently, so that would help to drive traffic during that slowdown period. Another thing that that people could do is do something from a standpoint of, hey, bring in a top person from outside of Chicago. I mean, do a luau, something that we know that's going to be totally different than what we're going to possibly do in January in Chicago. And then also, and again, is have established your labor model. Again, we go back to that again, and making sure that we've been prepared for it internally as well, so that we're not taking the hit that we always do take, even though we think that maybe we won't this time.
Doug has brought with us today here in the studio, you can see a number of different items that seem to be retail items. This is another thing, too, that we're seeing more of. You've got the Frontera salsa there. You have the Black Hawk spinning bowl dressing as well. Everybody knows that. Is this another way, too, that restaurants can put some of their signature items in the hands of folks who are going to the grocery store?
Really good point. I grew up with a dressing. It didn't necessarily send me to college from the standpoint of being a profitable item, but what it was, as you're saying, is a good way to cross-pollinate with the guest who is not necessarily in the restaurant, but is shopping and identifies and says, oh, yeah, you know, there's the Blackhawk spinning salad dressing. Let me pick up some for home. Because what happens is, if it's not our dressing or if it's not Frontera's products, which are off the charts, and recently we're sold for an astronomical amount of money, and as we know, the restaurant business is about nickels, dimes, and quarters. There's a lot more room on the retail shelf to having a little bit more profitability for food companies. So it's wonderful if you're able to have a product line that you're able to put into stores and be able to use that as a means of branding and continuing to reinforce the name of your group or the name of your restaurant. Excellent way of also increasing revenue. For us, wasn't so big. But for Frontera, it's been a home run.
It seems to be the ultimate compliment, where there's something so good at your restaurant, people think about it when they're not there and they want to get it.
Well, that goes back to what we've discussed before. You got to have craves. And when we talk about craves again, if it isn't the stone crabs at Joe's, as it years ago was the spinning salad bowl at my father's restaurant and grandfather's restaurant, if it isn't the cheesecake that Eli's has, all of these things are craves over a period of time, and people want them. So if you can't provide them necessarily in the restaurant, provide them in a retail opportunity.
Doug, we want to remind people the reason why you come in and visit with us here in the Opening Bell. You're a thought leader in this area, but you're also in business. How can people get a hold of you, and what kinds of things are you working on?
Well, I work on everything from helping hotel groups rediscover what some of their restaurants are today. Hotels historically have had issues with being predominant in the restaurant community, and what we like to do is to work with them in finding concepts that are approachable for individuals, both who are staying on property and those also who might not be staying on property. So we work in developing concept with hotels. We also do that with restaurant groups and helping them, again, find a holistic approach to trying to figure what next steps are in the hospitality business. And we also ourselves like developing concepts. And we take those concepts and we also license them, or we possibly also work with hotel groups and seeing those concepts throughout the country as well.
What is your favorite of the group here that you've brought in, some of the items?
Well, we have everything from Lowry's. I got to say that I've always been a big fan of Lowry's, and the family is a wonderful group out of California. I would have to say that their seasoning salt has been one of my favorites over years, and it's been around for years. Obviously, I have a great fondness for what Bayless has done with his products. There is no favorite. They're all like children at this point. You love them for one reason or another, hopefully that they grow up to be wonderful additions to your family. And
delicious adults, as it were. Young, delicious adults.
Young, delicious adults is a perfect way of presenting that.
Doug, always great conversation. Good to see you, and we'll see you again next time.
Look forward to being here.
Doug Roth, the founder and president of Playground Hospitality, Chicago restaurant consultancy. We'll continue our conversation with Doug after the bell and post that with our podcast of the opening bell later this morning at WGNradio.com.
Hi, this is Jim Dahlke with today's Inno Minute on WGN Radio, a rundown of all the Chicago innovation and tech news you need to know, delivered by ChicagoInno.com. Facebook is growing its Chicago presence, adding 3 floors and 100,000 more square feet to its Wacker Drive building. The Chicago Tribune says the space will be big enough for up to 500 additional workers. The company said in February that it had 70 Chicago employees. Chicago artificial intelligence startup Neurensic has been acquired by software firm Trading Technologies. Neurensic works with financial businesses to help spot fraudulent trading practices and has raised over $8 million to date. Luxury Garage Sale, a Chicago consignment startup that sells gently used designer brands, has hired Trish Lukasik as its new CEO. Lukasik comes from fellow Chicago startup Spa Hero, where she served as COO. And a new company called Popbox is opening in Lincoln Park that lets online startups open pop-up retail stores. Its brands include meal kit startup Home Chef and wine delivery company Vinebox. That's today's Inno Minute from WGN Radio. Learn more at ChicagoInno.com and sign up for The Beat, our daily email newsletter.
WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is the opening bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here with us on our Wednesday edition of the program. Are billable hours on the endangered list at law firms? Claire Bushy is law and manufacturing reporter at Crane Chicago, and she is with us here this morning. Claire, good morning. Welcome to the opening bell.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
This is a cool story because we often think of, I guess, billable hours are sort of what we think about with law firms. Why would they be going away?
Well, let's take a step back. They are not going away in the immediate future. Your lawyer will still be happy to send you a bill. But the lawyers are getting better at how they approach pricing their services. By using technological innovations, they now have a better sense of what things actually cost. And so they have a better sense of being able to put a price on something rather than just charging by the hour.
I'm guessing there's something, maybe an algorithm or artificial intelligence at play here. Am I right?
Yes, absolutely. You can use software that allows you to actually drill down into all the records that you have built up over the years of billing matters by the hour and get a sense of what type of legal matter, what the seniority of the attorneys who worked on it, and therefore get a better sense of what it actually costs to produce. And then, of course, once you know your costs, you can set a better price.
And how is that impacting business at law firms? I know you've been writing about this. Do you have any examples of how this is bringing more money into these law firms?
Well, at Neil Gerber and Eisenberg, a longtime local firm, the chief financial officer has been using software to do exactly this process. And he says that it allows him to set a more competitive price than he might otherwise be able to, a lower price. And of course, that is something that is attractive to clients. And when you can set a lower price, you have more chance of winning the business.
One of the examples, too, I saw you say that this saved one law firm $10 million or earned them about $10 million in revenue during a period. That's big money.
Yes, Baker & McKenzie brings in revenue of a couple billion, but for this is a short program, and it very quickly brought in $10 million in revenue. And it's just an example of what you can do when you start treating a law firm the same as any other business.
I guess it's a double-edged sword, too, because I was reading in another place that, you know, the software part of this, AI is enabling law firms to sometimes remove people from their staffs because it can read through these documents pretty quickly. That's the other part of the story, isn't it?
Well, for a long time, law firms have, I would say for the last 10 years, law firms have been outsourcing more and more of some of this lower-end work called document review. We used to think of associates at law firms going through warehouses of documents. That really doesn't happen anymore. The lawyers who do that work don't work at the firms already. So those jobs are actually already gone. But yes, losing jobs is one of the almost unavoidable results of technological change.
A lot of these law firms have been around for a long time. How difficult is it for them to incorporate new technologies into what they do?
It is difficult. One of the business people that I spoke with for the story said, the hardest part of my job is telling a room full of rich people that the thing that they did to get rich isn't going to work anymore. So lawyers at their best are not known for embracing change. The executives who are working in these law firms to try to implement some of these changes have a hard road to hoe.
I didn't know this until I read your story, that there are now people in these law firms, the title pricing director, that sort of lead these efforts increase billable hours, right?
Yes, there's a whole class of professionals who work in the largest law firms now who have business backgrounds. They are not lawyers necessarily. Some of them are. But they are people who are trying to take the same pretty straightforward disciplines that would be in place at any corporation and impose them in environments where they are completely foreign.
You mentioned earlier Neil Gerber, the software they're using there. How does a law firm like that, how do they advertise that they're doing this or get across to potential clients that they're sort of streamlining this process and could maybe save them money?
It's a challenge. Everyone is sort of trying to do the same thing right now, and they're all at various stages of that process. It involves, it involves talking to your long-term clients. It involves, when you pitch a new client, emphasizing some of these changes that you've made in order to be able to offer a lower, better price. And you also stress that in any sort of business development marketing that you're doing when you go to when you go out to meet potential new clients.
Claire, what else might be on the horizon at some of these law firms? Is this the software and the AI, are these the only new trends that are happening, or is there more?
Well, there is a new company based in the UK that I heard about recently, and one of the things that has been happening is that for document review, only a small sample of the documents are actually read, and then a computer goes and pours through the rest of them to try to find relevant information. This new company is actually created technology that reads the entire universe of documents. So that could potentially save even more time. And it also means that you need fewer lawyers to work on the universe of documents. So that's a potential change.
All right. Claire, good to talk with you this morning. Come back and join us again here in the opening bell.
Thank you. You have a good one.
All right. Claire Bushey is law and manufacturing reporter at Crane Chicago Business. You can read her work at cranes.com, and we will link out to her latest story on this as well. And you can follow her on Twitter at Claire. That's Claire with an E with an underscore B-U-S-H-E-Y.
You're listening to the opening bell on 720 WGN.
Now the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk. Future is still flat to negative this morning. Dow futures off 2. NASDAQ and S&P futures are off about a point each. The latest now on commodities and agriculture. Good morning, Orion Samuelson.
Good morning, Steve. Well, we waited another day for the crop progress harvest reports from USDA because of the Columbus Day holiday. And the report yesterday afternoon showed that 22% of the corn acres had been harvested by Sunday. That's well below the five-year average of 37%. And of Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, Illinois, the leader, with 38% harvested. Crop conditions a little bit better, but not much change in the good to excellent category for corn. Turning to soybeans, soybean acres harvested coming in at 36%. That's a little below the 43% five-year average. And Illinois, the leading state in soybean harvest in the Midwest, with 52% harvested. And that's what the traders will be looking at the rest of the week. But they'll probably be looking more at the government reports on Thursday. That's the October supply-demand report and updated estimates of U.S. and global crop production. Today, corn and soybean futures fractionally lower on technical selling. Wheat futures down, with a December contract hitting a four-week low as traders position themselves for the Thursday reports. And November soybeans ended down just 0.75 cents at $9.66 a bushel. You have a great day. I'm Orion Samuels.
Now the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk Outlook for Wednesday, October 11th. The U.S. Labor Department releases the job openings and labor turnover survey for August. President Trump and Prime Minister Justin Trudeau meet at the White House. NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, on their agenda. OPEC releases its monthly oil market report for October. The Federal Open Market Committee meeting minutes are published at 1 o'clock Chicago time. And the World Bank President, easy for me to say, Kim, and IMF Managing Director Lagarde speak at the Civil Society Town Hall. Possible news about global economy coming from that. Some of the things that could move the markets on this Wednesday, October 11th.